This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. For 15 years, Mark Plotkin has spent time with Indians who inhabit the rainforests in the northeast corner of the Amazon Basin in South America. This lush and diverse part of the world houses an astounding array of medicinal plants which have been used by native tribes who have lived there for thousands of years. Plotkin is an ethnobotanist and apprenticed himself to tribal healers to better understand the medicinal uses of Amazonian plants. He's concerned not only about the destruction of rainforest plants, but also worried that the knowledge of the tribal healers will be lost as well. Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice is Plotkin's account of his education in the rainforest and his efforts to preserve the wisdom of the tribal healers. Plotkin was educated at some of the finest schools in the states, Harvard, Yale, and Tufts, but he said nothing compared to what he learned about plants and medicine from the shamans and the people who lived in the forest.
When we look at the forest, we see a source of green, a source of timber, but when these indigenous peoples look at it, they see a drugstore, a toy store, a perfume store, you name it, and they can make it from rainforest products. And as a drugstore, it's a supermart, it's a Walmart, it's the biggest and the best of everything. You've got treatments there for just about every disease that afflicts our species, and many diseases which haven't arisen yet, and possibly diseases from which we suffer, for which we, as of yet, with Western medicine, have no cure.
Tell us what we use. What is in our medicine cabinet that comes from the rainforest?
Well, recent estimates are about 12% of our prescription drugs come from rainforest plants, and there's many other non-prescription drugs that come from there as well. Curare, used by the Indians as an arrow poison, used by us in Western medicine as a muscle relaxant abdominal surgery, comes from the jungles of the northwest Amazon. Reserpine, which is an important hypotensive agent, that is, it slows down the heart rate or the blood pressure, comes to us from Indian snake root. Many of the things used in the dentist's office, like Novocaine, is actually a synthetic based on cocaine, which comes from Western South America. There's many, many plants out there that already benefit us from the rainforest, and what I think is worth emphasizing is how many more are out there that can benefit us if we protect the forest, if we collect the information on which these plants are useful from the people who know these plants best.
Tell us how an ethnobotanist works, and that's what and who you are.
Well, an ethnobotanist's job is to work with tribal peoples to find new and useful plants, usually in the tropical rainforest, and every one of us has our own methodologies. I tend to go into the forest with a shaman or a medicine man or a witch doctor, what have you, and with a young member of the tribe. And the young member usually speaks several different languages, which makes it easier to communicate, and also very adept at climbing these trees, which soar into way up into the canopy, 120 feet. And I place myself behind the medicine man and in front of the younger fellow to show the medicine man that I'm there to follow his lead. And also, because we're really the dim country cousins in the big city for the first time, and we're in the rainforest with indigenous peoples, they like to look out for you and keep you in between them so you don't do something stupid like pick up the wrong plant or step on a snake or something that no self-respecting indigenous person, no mistake they'd ever make.
Describe for us, if you can, then, how these people do live in the rainforest. What does a village look like?
Well, what makes life in the rainforest possible is plants. And when you go into these villages, what you see is people and plants. The houses are made from palm thatch. They may be shaped like igloos. They may be shaped like beehives. They may be shaped nothing more than lean-tos. The poles in the houses are forest saplings. The women are sitting there grating cassava, which is a forest plant which has been domesticated by these peoples, grating, grating, grating. You always hear that ch-ch-ch-ch-ch sound in every indigenous village. The little girls may be making bread from the cassava. The men are sharpening their arrows, which are made from forest plants, to ready to go out hunting. Their bows are made from forest trees of the fig family to go out hunting. Everything is made from forest plants.
How would you describe their relationship with the forest around them?
Well, I'd say pretty much they're very much a part of the ecosystem, and I mean that as the highest compliment. They are in and of the ecosystem itself. They know the ecosystem better than any university-trained botanist does, and remember that none of these plants were learned of by Harvard or Yale or Cambridge or Oxford-trained botanists. They were all discovered like Columbus discovered America. The Indians got there first. And when they're living their traditional lifestyle, they're part of the ecosystem. But when we go in there with our religion or our technology and begin to disrupt their traditional relationship, with even the best of intentions in many cases, they start to lose their dependence on the rainforest, and that cycle is broken.
Describe for us, if you can, your introduction, and there was a guide you had named Fritz, and it seemed the way you wrote about it that this was really your first introduction into the rainforest, where the job was to try to understand the plants that were all around you.
Well, Fritz von Thrun is the greatest botanist I've ever met. This is a barely literate man of a Maroon tribe, which is a tribe of Afro-Americans. These were Africans brought to the Amazon in the 17th and 18th century to be slaves on the sugar plantations. These guys took one look around and said, hey, this is equatorial rainforest, we'll see you white boys later, and took off for the interior where they maintain what are essentially West African tribal lifestyles to the current day. And Fritz von Thrun, it sounds like a good Dutch name.
Yeah,
I expected
sure
this little Dutch boy with a pageboy haircut and wooden shoes, and here was this huge, muscular Afro-American man who turned out to know more about botany than I could ever hope to learn.
Well, describe for us how he took you into the forest and how he related to the plants around him.
Well, he took me into the forest and began to show me the many uses they have for plants, not just medicines, but drinks, but vines to make ropes or hammocks, plants used by his ancestors to survive when they'd escaped into the jungle to escape the overseers. And it was really an eye-opener because I began to see that this wasn't something just beautiful, but really something that could provide all the sources to make life possible.
Well, I got the feeling, the way you wrote, that every step of the way was, at least for you, this whole new drugstore, if we can use that again, of plants. And around the next corner was a whole other one.
Every step into the rainforest the first time was a revelation, because every few feet there'd be a medicine or a fiber or an essential oil or some sort of useful plants. And it just showed me how, with my Western education being turned loose in the rainforest, I was just in a sea of green. But with an indigenous or a semi-indigenous guide, all of a sudden you understand how to use the forest, how these things can benefit us, and it makes you appreciate not only the potential of these species which are being lost, but the importance of the knowledge of these species, which really exists in the heads of the men and women who know the forest best.
What kinds of sicknesses do people get who, the indigenous tribes who live in the rainforest?
Well, of course, the great tragedy of these introduced diseases, for which they often have no cure. Now, you give these guys another 20,000 years, and maybe they can find the cure for the common cold, but they haven't had 20,000 years to find plants against it, only 500 years since it's been introduced. But nonetheless, I think a very important point worth underlining is that the greatest scourge in human history is malaria. Malaria has killed more people than any other two diseases combined, and the frontline drug for malaria is quinine, which comes from Western South America. Now, quinine was first discovered and taught to us by the South American Indians. So they did, in those 500 years, find the cure to the greatest disease from which people have ever suffered.
My guest is Mark Plotkin. He's an ethnobotanist and the author of a book called Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. Tell us what they thought of you, at least as you could figure it out when you arrived there. It seemed like you were the source of a lot of amusement to the local people.
Well, this is why it's so ironic to ethnobotanists to see these movies like Medicine Man, where the great white medicine man goes in and teaches the Indian everything. The fact of the matter is, you're just kind of a dim-witted country cousin to these people in the big city for the first time. And they regard you, at best, as a harmless oddball, and at worst, as sort of a silly interloper who's there to teach, to try and steal, actually, their tribal secrets. When I went into the first Indian village which I worked in, they referred to me as the Pananakiti, which means the alien. And so they didn't even regard me as the same species. They thought I was from another planet. But only by spending time with these people and building up a relationship based on trust and friendship and even love that they really began to open up to me and teach me the secrets of the plants they knew and used.
Well, we should also add that you were known as White Man Who Falls on His Ass.
Yes.
How did you earn
Banana
that
Kiri,
name?
Banana Kiri no nota tementa, which is the white man who falls on his ass. I was working with this old witch doctor, at least I went to work with him, and we're going across this forest stream. Now, what we think of as a bridge is something you can drive across. These guys fell a forest sapling maybe 2 or 3 inches across and then dance across it like a little deer. Well, I went across it with this great medicine man and ended up ass over tea kettle. Well, he thought this was the funniest thing he'd ever seen and labeled me the white man who falls on his ass. And 8 years later, every year I'd go back there, he'd say, look, it's the white man who falls on his ass. So 8 years later, I was convinced this really wasn't as funny as it was almost a decade earlier, but he still got a tremendous charge out of that.
How does one become a shaman?
Well, traditionally, it varies from culture to culture and tribe to tribe. And with the Tirios, which is the tribe that I know best, You had to apprentice yourself to the medicine man. It was often the son of the medicine man, or it was somebody who had to volunteer or was chosen by the medicine man. You had to undergo 4 years of training, which is equivalent to a university education. You had to go through certain dietary restrictions. You had to put up with certain sexual restrictions. You then had to take a very hallucinogenic plant to commune with the spirit world. And then you had to learn which plants and which chants could be used to cure people.
What position do they hold then within the local society?
Well, traditionally, the two paramount positions in this tribe were the chief and the medicine man. But with the advent of missionary activity, the medicine man has been very much discredited because with the introduction of introduced medicines, which are highly effective against introduced diseases, and with an introduced religion, some of these people had a vested interest in saying the medicine man was really a person from the past who had no role in the future of these societies. So you still have the chief, and in many of these villages, you still have the medicine men. But in a lot of cases, the medicine men are dying out, and that's where the race comes in to save this information before it irretrievably disappears.
You worked with a master healer who you called the Jaguar Shaman. Tell us how you came to call him that.
Well, I'd worked with this old medicine man for 3 days, and it was a very enigmatic relationship because he never smiled, but he always scowled, in fact, and he obviously resented the fact that I had come from so far away to learn his sacred tribal secrets. By the same token, he obviously really appreciated the fact that I wanted to learn from him, whereas the young people in his village had no interest in the old ways, and he referred to me again as the Pananakiti, the alien. So after 3 days, he turned to a YY Indian who was interpreting, since I didn't speak Tidio at the time, and said, tell the Pananakiti that I've taught him all I'm going to teach him. He says, tomorrow I'm going hunting. Well, that night I was sleeping in my hammock, and I had an incredibly vivid dream of this enormous jaguar strolling into my hut and fixing me with this incredible scowl. I woke up with a scream and a cold sweat and looked around, but there was nothing there. No footprints on the dirt floor, just the sound of the wind blowing through the palm trees at the edge of the village. Well, the next morning, the YY Indian came to my hut and said, let's go look for some more plants. And I said, no. I said, go find the old shaman before he goes hunting and tell him that last night I saw the jaguar. Now, mind you, I gave no further explanation. Well, the fellow went off and came back a few minutes later, and I said, did you find him? He said, yes. I said, did you tell him? He said, yes. I said, well, what did he say? He said he broke into a big smile and said, that was me.
How did you interpret both the dream and his reaction to your dream?
Well, if you know the anthropology of South American cultures, you know that the jaguar is often the symbol of the shaman. The jaguar is the most powerful animal in the forest. The jaguar is the most frightening animal in the forest, and the jaguar walks and hunts by night. And there's tale after tale after tale of shamans claiming they can turn themselves into jaguars. Now, was this a dream? Was this a hallucination? Was this me reading too much anthropological literature? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, it broke the ice between us, and ever since then, this fellow has treated me as sort of an adopted son and taught me many, many, many healing plants that just weren't being shown to me at the outset.
Did it free you in any way from the kind of reality that you brought into the Amazon rainforest,
into
the villages there?
I think what it taught me was that these separate realities do exist, and that being willing to put aside your own preconceptions and to be willing to open your eyes to things that they consider very real or these alternate realities opens a sort of line of communication which is not open to some hotshot scientist trained in some ivory tower institution and a guy in a breechcloth. And when you realize that these people know things you don't, that these people can teach you things that you can't learn in a classroom, it creates the means to communicate on other planes.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin, and he's just written a new book. It's called Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin. It seems that a lot of the kind of medicine that is being done in the Amazon rainforest really mixes ceremony with healing. Is that something that you've thought about and even thought about what might be missing in the American form of medicine?
A colleague of mine in West, who's a medical anthropologist, said that Western medicine often cures, but it doesn't heal. And I think what he means by that is this holistic approach to healing, which involves treating all aspects of the patient. So it's not just this magic bullet approach, which I think Western medicine has been obsessed with for quite some time. And I believe that indigenous healers who've been using things like visualization, massage, aromatherapy for thousands and thousands of years, would find it highly ironic when Western medicine starts discovering things like visualization and massage and aromatherapy. So I believe that there are a lot of things we can learn from these people. First and foremost, new therapeutic compounds, but perhaps attitudes towards treating patients as well.
Tell us what these indigenous peoples can learn from Western medicine.
Well, in Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, I point out that there are medicines that we have that they don't have, which are effective for diseases which can really devastate an entire tribe. Things like mumps or measles, or basic treatments for the common cold, at least when they're bacterial in origin, and other things which have come in there which they couldn't treat because they haven't had long enough time to find a plant that can cure it. I believe that plants can cure just about any ailment, I won't say all of them, and some of these things we've introduced and we've developed very effective treatments for.
Well, you've been an ethnobotanist for more than a decade now. What plants have you been able to gather? And tell us what, as you've brought them back to the States here, if they've been made in any particular kinds of medicines or where that has taken medical research in this country.
Well, I've sat on my plants for the better part of a decade. I didn't want to turn it over to a pharmaceutical company which was going to find the cure for X, Y, or Z, synthesize it, make zillions of dollars, and leave the poor Indians in the dust. And as a result of this, there's been another groundswell in the ethnobotanical community to realize this type of cut-and-run approach is no longer viable. And a group of people got together and set up a company called Shaman Pharmaceuticals in the San Francisco area, which is predicated on the idea that not only are we going to find new and useful drugs from indigenous peoples, which in fact we have, but that a percentage of the proceeds should flow back to indigenous peoples, first and foremost, to the countries from which these plants come from, particularly these tropical countries, and into rainforest conservation as a whole. And now we at Conservation International, the environmental organization with which I work, are now brokering an agreement between indigenous peoples in the Northeast Amazon, the national government of Suriname, and a major pharmaceutical firm to do just this sort of thing, which is to make sure that we are using ethnobotany as a guide and that make sure that a percentage of the profits go back to these peoples.
Tell us about an old football wound of yours, and this is something that has really dogged you for a lot of your adult life.
Well, fortunately, it doesn't dog me anymore,
right?
Because the medicine man cured it. I was living next to a gymnasium when I was in forestry school at Yale, and I guess I had a few too many hormones in my system at the time. I started lifting weights every day. So I damaged my elbow, what they call chronic tendonitis, which is a great diagnosis, except they couldn't cure it. So they gave me ultrasound, they gave me ice water baths, nothing happened. Then I went off to Harvard as a researcher and got this top-notch physician who made the same diagnosis and pumped me full of steroids. Not only did that not make me better, it hurt like hell. So finally I was down in Wayana country, and I found this great Wayana medicine man. And after collecting plants with him a few days, I was sufficiently impressed by his abilities as a healer to say, look, grandfather, you know, I've got this terrible problem with my elbow. Do you think you can treat it? Well, the guide, who was a young Wayana, said, Hey, he says, look, he says, don't test this guy. He says, you know, this is a very serious and a very dangerous man. He says, I hope you're not doing this to test this guy, because this could get you in a lot of trouble. If you've got an injury, he can heal it. But don't be playing games with him. I said, I assure you, this is somebody that I would not be playing with. So the fellow brought me through an entire curing ceremony, building a hut of palm thatch in the jungle, treating me with tobacco smoke, magic herbs, chants, and it hasn't bothered me since.
You also describe a kind of out-of-body experience, or that you fell into a kind of a trance.
Well, I sort of felt myself going under, sort of like a hypnosis, hypnotic trance, and then I felt myself floating up, and I looked down, and there I lay. And somebody asked me recently, says, well, certainly you're not suggesting this is the future of Western medicine. And I pointed out that I'm not suggesting that my physician friends here in the United States start trying to induce out-of-body experiences in all their patients. What I'm suggesting is that there are things from this man, from these plants, that we can learn and take advantage of through our own medical system.
Do you know what the plants were?
Professional secret.
Is that right?
He wouldn't tell me.
Oh, he wouldn't tell you. Well, then how are we supposed to learn all this stuff?
Well, you know, he didn't tip his hand. He didn't show all of his cards, but he taught me plenty plants, and there are leads in these plants which are worth following up. But, you know, I mean, this is just how people are that indulge in a trade. Nobody teaches you everything at the outset. And I might add that when I went back to learn from him, and I'd collected over 100 different plants he used for medical purposes, he was one of the famous, one of the paramount shamans of the tribe. When I finally got back down there to work with him, it was too late because he died out.
Oh, gosh. When you're sick in the United States, what do you do for the sort of everyday illnesses, the fevers, the headaches, the earaches?
Well, I can't answer that in any one way because it depends on the illness and depends on where I am. Because there are things that I go to the physician for. If I have acute appendicitis, I want to be treated by a surgeon. But if I have a fungal infection of the skin, I wait till I get back in the rainforest and use the plants that the indigenous peoples have taught me. I've had stomach ailments coming out of the fact that I've had parasites so many damn times, which Western physicians really couldn't treat successfully. So I went to a fellow who was practicing Chinese medicine, and he cleared me right up. I mean, the point, again, is that no system has all of the answers, and you have to be willing to experiment and try different systems to find what may be best for you.
You've described the difficulty, or at least the changes that are happening inside some of these indigenous villages in the Amazon rainforest, and the concern that you have about protecting them from the outside world. Is there a danger at all of you being paternalistic about that kind of protection?
Well, I think there is a danger, and I'm not the one who decides what they learn and what they don't learn. What I want to do is make sure they know the value of their own culture and they're not giving up everything and throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I point out, I'm not telling them that everything we have is wrong and that they shouldn't be wearing clothes or they shouldn't be having radios. What I'm telling them is giving up their medicines is a real mistake because there are many instances of them getting hooked on outside medicines and then the missionaries go away or the government officials go away or economic chaos happens in these third world countries and they don't have access to outside medicines and then they're left with nothing. No Western medicine, no indigenous medicine.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Plotkin is author of Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. He's also vice president of ethnobotany at Conservation International. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.